This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Katie Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The Center for Constitutional Rights has staked out a case for all humanity in its suing the United States government, Biden, Blinken, and Austin for their complicity in the war in Gaza.
We'll also speak with attorney Carrie Shankman about the prosecution of Julian Assange and the Espionage Act in general.
Attorney Carrie Shankman has written a great book, A Century of Repression, The Espionage Act and Freedom of the Press, and this is exactly what they're using against Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We talk today about the lawsuit against President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin. They're defendants in a lawsuit brought in the Northern District of California called Defense for Children International, Palestine versus Biden. The plaintiffs have been represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Mark Vanderhoot. The suit is to end American complicity with Israel in the slaughter of the Palestinian people in Gaza. Following an historic hearing that included testimony from some Palestinian plaintiffs and witnesses as to the scale of destruction in Gaza and impact on their families and communities, on January 31st of this year, a federal trial court in Northern California found that Israel's assault and siege of the Palestinian people in Gaza possibly constituted genocide and implored the Biden administration to explain its unflagging support for Israel. Notwithstanding these findings, the court denied the Center for Constitutional Rights' preliminary injunction motion and granted the government's motion to dismiss the case on the grounds that it lacked jurisdiction over the administration of foreign relations. The CCR appealed the decision. The appeal was argued on June 10, 2024. We speak today with CCR attorney Catherine Gallagher, who was part of the CCR legal team. Attorney Catherine Gallagher, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Catherine, please tell us something about the individuals and organizations that the CCR is representing in the lawsuit against Biden, Blinken, and Austin.
So the case that we filed back in mid-November is on behalf of 8 plaintiffs. Two of them are Palestinian human rights organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine, and, of course, as we have seen, this genocide has been felt so strongly in terms of loss of life of children, the next generation of Palestine. So the work that DCI Palestine is doing is so important. They are the lead named plaintiff. The other organizational plaintiff is Al-Haq, which is the oldest Palestinian human rights organization. And then we have 3 plaintiffs who are Gaza-based, one of whom is Ahmed Abu Artema, who may be known to your listeners as one of the founders of the Great March of Return, which was an effort to really lift the siege of Gaza peacefully already back in 2020 and have Palestinians able to return. So he is a plaintiff. He had his home bombed and lost a child in that assault on his home, on that bombing of his home. The other 2 Gaza-based plaintiffs are Dr. Omar El-Najjar, who is a medical resident and so has had a terrifyingly up-close understanding of the loss of life and what is happening in this genocide. And then a 3rd plaintiff, Mohammed Ahmed Abu Rakba, who is a human rights advocate in Gaza. So those are our 3 Gaza-based plaintiffs. And then we have 5 U.S. citizens of Palestinian descent, and they are Palestinians who have lost collectively over 200 family members over the last 8 months in Gaza, who have watched family homes be bombed and destroyed, and who have really stepped forward here in the U.S. to be on the front lines of pushing their government to protect their people from this ongoing onslaught and effort to destroy the Palestinian population in whole or in part. So that is who our 8 plaintiffs are. This is very much a litigation that is plaintiff-led and partnership, a deep partnership in trying to push collectively through the litigation and, of course, beyond through the movement to end the U.S. support for genocide.
I understand that the testimony was powerful and emotionally stirring. Can you talk in a bit more detail about what the plaintiffs testified to?
Sure. So we have had two hearings in this case. In January, we had a hearing before the district court judge, Judge White, where the plaintiffs were actually able to testify. And so that included four of the five Palestinian American plaintiffs, testimony from the head of DCI Palestine in Ramallah, and Dr. Omar El-Nashar testifying from a hospital in Gaza. And they testified to truly, those plaintiffs in Palestine testified to the death and destruction that they are bearing witness to on a daily basis and trying to survive themselves. And then the Palestinian American plaintiffs, including Leila El-Haddad, you know, she spoke about what it was like to have her great aunt, who she has spent so much time with during family visits every year in Gaza, who taught her how to cook Palestinian food and the importance of Palestinian heritage, what it was like to lose her family members. Bassem El-Kara spoke about the bombing of a family home that he would go to visit. Ahmed Abu Ful talked about watching his university, the pain of watching his university literally blown up for no reason other than to destroy part of Palestinian culture, history, and life. So we had that testimony in January, and that is what led District Court Judge White to find that there is a plausible genocide and that the U.S. has, quote, unflagging support in the form of sending munitions. The vast majority of weapons being used in Gaza against Palestinians are U.S. transferred or U.S. made weapons. So that testimony was heard in January. And what it was frankly disturbing was, despite making that finding, Judge White found that the case could not proceed because it implicated the political question doctrine, which essentially is a doctrine that has courts abstain even where there's proper jurisdiction, where courts say, oh, the matter before us is political. We have to defer to whether it's the executive branch or Congress, and we shouldn't get involved. So what was quite disturbing about Judge White's finding, which is a position the U.S. government pushed there and is pushing again, is that it is saying, even if what is largely recognized as the most serious legal obligation to prevent and not further genocide. Genocide is a crime. It's a crime under international law. It's a crime under domestic law. The judge found that even if this crime is being aided and abetted by the President of the United States, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense, the courts have to stand back. So that was the conclusion from the district court ruling, and that is what we just argued the appeal on Monday, June 10th in San Francisco to a three-panel court of appeals where we urged three appellate judges to reverse the dismissal of the case and to recognize that this case raises a fundamental question of whether presidents are bound by law or can operate outside and above the law. So we see this appeal as fundamental, of course, first and foremost, to trying to stop the flow of weapons from the United States to Gaza, which is to Israel for use in Gaza, which is a form of aiding and abetting complicity in genocide. Again, that is a crime, the most serious crime under international and domestic law. So whether the court is going to apply the law or whether it's going to give a free pass just because the government says that what they are doing in Gaza through their support to Israel is just a foreign policy choice. And we say supporting genocide can never be a foreign policy choice.
Attorney Catherine Gallagher, you got supporting briefs from former military leaders, diplomats, human rights groups, and non-governmental organizations. Please talk about what these people contributed.
Sure. In support of the appeal, like we also had in support of the district court proceedings, we had here 8 amicus briefs, and they were from a range of different voices. One of them was constitutional and federal courts scholars who were impressing upon the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals the importance of separation of powers, the fact that the judiciary needs to, under the constitutional structure, needs to serve as a check on unlawful executive conduct. And as we argue, that is what is at issue in this case, unlawful conduct by the president and 2 of his senior cabinet members. We also had 17 former diplomats, service members, and intelligence officers put in an amicus brief where they talked about the loss of moral authority and the risk of kind of retribution to the United States if the U.S. and the U.S. courts fail to uphold U.S. obligations under international law and domestic law when it comes to preventing and punishing genocide. So their brief was speaking, again, to the larger context that this case is operating in. And as much as the executive is pushing the court to say, hey, anything that we say is foreign policy, you can't look at, these former diplomats and service members were saying, no, we need the protections of international law. We need the international legal system to apply equally to all, including for our own protection. So please, court, apply the law. And then we also heard that sentiment echoed from a different constituency. That's over 135 human rights organizations, bar associations, social justice movement organizations from literally around the world who are all speaking about the importance of the U.S. upholding the international legal framework that was adopted after the horrors of the Holocaust and the horrors of World War II, where 30 million civilians died, and warned of the ripple effect. If the United States fails to uphold international law, the ripple effect in other places where democracy is even more vulnerable than it is in the United States, or where authoritarians can easily point to U.S. hypocrisy and say, why should we not also commit genocide against those minority groups in our country that we don't want? So we had the human rights organizations. We also had 11 civil rights and grassroots organizations who represent the interests of Palestinian Americans, Black, Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian communities who were speaking about the particular vulnerabilities and, frankly, Islamophobia and anti-Black racism that is an animating sentiment in a case like this, potentially, where you see that some groups are protected from the law and other groups are not. So we really had a range of voices, including experts on mass starvation, who detailed horrors on the ground, the fact that 2 million Palestinians, and again, the children are the most vulnerable, are facing famine and mass starvation. And they laid out how that particular crime has been specifically the focus of international war crimes prohibitions, as well as how mass starvation can be used as a tool of genocide. So all of these briefs are also there before the Ninth Circuit, showing the importance of this case, the importance of the rule of law, international law being upheld, and the demand for the courts to serve as a check on unlawful executive power.
After losing at the trial level, Katie, you appealed to the Circuit Court in the Northern District of California. The argument was last Monday, June 10th. What points did you make in your arguments?
We really put forward to the 3 judges on the appellate court, Judge Nguyen, Judge Callahan, and Judge Bress, that this case is a test whether the executive branch can tell the judiciary it must stand aside, powerless, while the executive violates binding law simply because the case involves foreign affairs. So we explained to the appellate court something that they frankly know very well, and that's that since the founding of this country, Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court has said that the judiciary, really their job is to serve as a check when a legal duty, when the law is alleged to be violated by the executive branch, whether through a violation of the Constitution, a violation of a statute, or a violation of international law, that the judiciary has a role and a responsibility to step in and review executive conduct and do so even in politically sensitive cases, even in times of war. We pointed the Court of Appeals to all of the decisions that CCR and Michael Ratner, who played such a huge role in this, won during the Bush 2 era around the quote-unquote enemy combatant cases, where the Supreme Court ruled 4 times in 4 years in a post-9/11 world that the courts can and must stand on as a check to executive power. We also pointed the Court of Appeals to the Zivotofsky rulings by the Supreme Court in the 2010s, where twice the Supreme Court reviewed on the merits, meaning that they didn't just throw the case out. This was a case that involved whether or not an American born in Jerusalem could say on their passport that they were born in Jerusalem, Israel, or whether it would just be Jerusalem, which is what the executive branch wanted. So that was a very politically fraught issue, but the Supreme Court was very clear that where all the court is being asked to do is apply binding law, the role is for the court to do that, just as it did in Marbury versus Madison, just as it did back in the Charming Betsy case during the War of 1812. The courts have a role to serve as a check on executive power. So we really tried to impress upon the Court of Appeals that this is a through line over 230 years of jurisprudence, of case law in the United States, that this is what the constitutional structure of separation of powers in a democracy demands, and hope that they look closely at the text of the Constitution here, especially the more conservative judges on the panel who often speak about originalism and textualism. We hope that they look carefully at the Constitution and the powers for the executive in Article 2, that those are very limited powers. There's no blank check that says foreign policy in Article 2 of the Constitution, and there isn't even a blank check in times of war. So this is a case where what needs to be applied is the absolute prohibition against complicity in genocide, aiding and abetting genocide. We need the court to step in and to tell President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of State Austin that they must review the steady flow of weapons that are going to Israel for use in Gaza and find that conduct, that knowing conduct, is aiding and abetting a genocide, and thus stop it.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, attorney Heidi Boghossian, and we're speaking with attorney Catherine Gallagher of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Catherine, what points did the government make against your arguments?
The government's position is a pretty stunning one. It really is saying we do deserve a blank check. But whenever we say foreign policy or diplomacy are implicated in a case, the courts have to stand down. That, in essence, was the government's position in its briefing and repeated at argument. And Judge Callahan asked the government attorney, so is there ever a circumstance where a court can apply the prohibition against genocide to a U.S. actor, to the president or a member of the executive branch? And the government lawyer said he could not think of one. So essentially was saying there is no circumstance that he sees the court having a role to prevent or punish a genocide. And that's a profoundly disturbing position. It's one that we hear President Biden admonish Donald Trump for making, that essentially an argument that a person, a president, is beyond the law. That's largely what the government was urging the Ninth Circuit to do, to say whenever there's foreign policy or diplomacy or something sensitive going on, courts have to stand back and let the executive even break the law.
With that in mind, how do you appreciate the effectiveness of your arguments, and how were you received by the judges?
You know, it was I would say what we would call it is a pretty hot bench. There were a good number of questions to me over the course of the 20 minutes I had. It was pretty much nonstop questions. I wouldn't say that they were largely unexpected questions. They were tough questions. And at this point, I am going to hope that the judges were asking me the difficult questions about line drawing and implications of issuing an injunction in this case, because they're wrestling with doing what the Constitution demands, and that's applying the law to the President, the Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense, even in a time where the executive is saying, trust us, let us do what we want and do what we feel we need. So, you know, I'm not going to prejudge the outcome. Again, hoping that they were asking me the tough questions they were, because they are seeing that this case has some very serious ramifications, and it's really about them upholding their role to stop an ongoing genocide. That's what the stakes are here. So I hope that they do what the law really says very clearly to them, and what the law and our constitutional structure demands, and that they serve as a check on unlawful executive conduct.
You did succeed, however, in getting one of the appellate judges removed from the panel on the grounds that he might be perceived to be biased. Please tell us about that.
Sure. So in the Ninth Circuit, you actually don't find out who your panel, the three judges that you have for your appeal, you don't find that out until the week before the argument. So the argument was on June 10th, and on the morning of June 3rd, we received the names of our three judges. So we had Judge Bress, Judge Nguyen, and then the third judge who was on the panel was Judge Ryan Nelson. And what you quickly start doing is doing a review of their case law and trying to learn what you can about the judges. And what we learned was that Judge Ryan Nelson had participated in a World Jewish Congress delegation to Israel in March of this year. So after the appeal was docketed, as briefing was already going on in this case, so of course he could have been assigned to this appeal. He went on this, I'm going to use the word junket, you know, it was a trip that the organizers acknowledged was designed to influence judges. And they specifically said judges are influential people in the United States. So that is why 14 U.S. federal judges were brought on this trip. And during the trip, they met with Israeli officials. They met with members of the Israeli Defense Forces. They apparently, and this we learned from news reports and interviews with other judges who participated on the trip that are all out there in the public domain, that they heard the Israeli government's legal arguments about why what they're doing in Gaza is justified under the law and why it's lawful. So we felt that Judge Nelson's trip really raised some flags about whether he could be perceived as impartial in hearing the appeal. And we moved very quickly on Tuesday night with a recusal motion, laying out declarations of with all the information that we had learned about the trip, and laying out why we felt we had an ethical obligation, citing the ethical requirements on federal judges to move for recusal. And that motion went directly to Judge Ryan Nelson, who's been on the, the bench, I believe, since 2019 or 2020. He's a Trump appointee. And we are appreciative that Judge Nelson recognized that there could be a perception of impartiality. And he did, in fact, recuse himself on Thursday ahead of the argument. And so Judge Callahan was put on in his place.
Katie, Trump's recent conviction in the Stormy Daniels case has been heralded by some as proof of the soundness of the American justice system. But on the international level, after the International Court of Justice found that Israel was possibly committing genocide and recommended measures to curb that country's military, the judgment is being ignored by both Israel and the United States. Is this an indication to you that the international legal system established after World War II is coming unraveled?
I think at this moment, the international legal system is definitely under significant pressure. I think what we're seeing, the fact that we have proceedings around Palestine and the potential of both the State of Israel at the International Court of Justice and the Prime Minister of Israel potentially coming before the International Criminal Court as the prosecutor moved for an arrest warrant against him, I think we're in some ways seeing the international legal system working. There have been many, many times where I wished these international institutions were focusing on what was happening in Palestine. Gaza was under closure for 17 years, and I had worked with the Palestinian human rights organizations, Palestinian Center for Human Rights, Al-Nisan, El-Haq, who were urging the ICC prosecutor to look at that closure for what it was, which at minimum was a crime against humanity of persecution. And we did not have investigations. We did not have investigations after the 51-day assault on Gaza in the summer of 2014 that left over 1,000 civilians dead. So had we had arrest warrants at that point in time, we may not be having genocide now. So I'm again wishing that these institutions moved faster, that they actually had concrete results on the ground. But I think that they are engaged at this moment and focused on what is happening in Palestine writ large, and especially in Gaza with the unfolding genocide. I think that that is a positive step. And it is making countries decide, are they on the side of the rule of law or are they not? And I think we're seeing a growing isolation, certainly of Israel. And I think we're seeing a real questioning of the moral authority, the political authority, the legal authority of the United States when in the face of multiple rulings by the ICJ, multiple issuances of provisional measures, and also the International Court of Justice's ruling in the Nicaragua v. Germany case, where the U.S. judge, Judge Sarah Cleveland, issued a separate opinion where she warned that sending weapons to support a genocide or a war crime, that that's in violation of either the Geneva Conventions or the Genocide Convention. So we have these international courts now putting out some pretty stark warnings and some pretty clear admonishments of unlawful conduct. And I think history will be the judge as to whether this proves to be a defining moment where the U.S. loses even more power on the global stage than it has. But for the moment, my focus is really on us trying to end the horror that is happening on a daily basis in Gaza, increasingly reaching over borders and to other parts of Palestine, whether it's those Palestinians who are seeking refuge in Cairo or Palestinians in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, who are under even more pressure from the Israeli occupation and apartheid system. We need that to end very, very urgently.
We've been speaking with attorney Catherine Gallagher of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Catherine, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time. Could you very briefly tell us what the next steps are and then tell our audience how they can stay in touch with you and the CCR and follow this case?
Sure. So right now we'll be waiting for the opinion, the decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And again, while we hope it is a positive one, if it is not, we will likely continue on to a full review, a request for a full review by the Ninth Circuit. And we are engaging outside the courts. We are supporting the movement here in the United States and beyond, who are working so hard on the streets and in Congress, using so many peaceful tools to try and end the genocide. So our focus continues to be on the litigation, but also supporting the movement. And you can find information on the case at ccrjustice.org/DCIP-V-Biden. So just go to ccrjustice.org and you can search for Defense for Children International Palestine, and you'll have a range of materials, including filings in the case there, and can follow when we put out action alerts or calls for support.
I just wanted to mention that Mark Vanderhoot, his firm, was involved in this as well. He's got a law firm in San Francisco. I was on a trip with him and Abdi Jabara on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild in 1987 to investigate illegal actions by the Israelis. In any case, thank you so much for being our guest. Thank you for your heroic work on this case. And we'll be checking in with you later on. Thank you again.
Thank you so very much for having me on Law and Disorder. And thank you to your listeners. And indeed, thank you to Mark Vanderhout and his whole team. They're not just local counsel in this. They've been real true partners in this litigation. So there are so many around the world who are trying to end the genocide, and I'm grateful to be part of that effort.
Thanks, Katie. Take care.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
These are dire times for freedom of speech around the world. According to a recently released report, more than half of the world's population now lives in countries that are in a state of, quote, crisis, unquote, regarding freedom of speech. This is occurring during a year that has been marred by attacks on investigative journalism all over the world, which we have especially seen in elections in Mexico and India, as well as in the United States. Against this background, the United States is only adding gasoline to the media freedom fire by pursuing an ongoing prosecution and attempting to extradite WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange under a 100-year-old U.S. law called the Espionage Act of 1917. This prosecution threatens to set a dangerous precedent for journalists everywhere during these perilous times. Joining us to discuss the Espionage Act, the prosecution of Julian Assange, and the risks posed to freedom of the press is human rights attorney Carrie Shankman. He is a constitutional lawyer and serves on a panel of experts at Columbia University's Global Freedom of Expression program. He is co-author, along with Ralph Engelman, of A Century of Repression, The Espionage Act and Freedom of the Press. Carrie was recently appointed legal and policy advisor to the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression. He appears here today in his personal capacity, and his views are his own and not necessarily those of the Special Rapporteur. Carrie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Why should listeners be concerned about this 100-year-old Espionage Act, and how has it been used over the years?
So, Steve, I want to start by pointing out what folks often think when they hear about something called the Espionage Act of 1917. One, I want to debunk that this law is about old news. Sure, this law is 100 years old, but it's being used today. I have a news alert actually set up in my email every week for the Espionage Act, and every week my email inbox gets a full list of news stories about the Espionage Act. It's probably in the news dozens of times every week because it's actually being used against many, many folks. The second myth is that this thing is just for lawyers. When you hear about something called the Espionage Act, your eyes might glaze over a little bit. And I wrote a book on this stuff, but even then, the stuff, it can sound boring. It's often technical, often can even sound like a textbook. But actually, the impact of it is very wide. And when you hear Espionage Act of 1917, you might think that this is just this technical, dusty law. But this is something that journalists are writing about. It impacts a lot of people. It impacts people on a human level. It ruins lives. So it's really not some abstract law. And three, the last myth I really want to address is that this thing is about spies. The main problem with the Espionage Act is that it's being sold as a spy law by the Justice Department. It's being sold as about national security. And I think a lot of folks, when they hear Espionage Act, they think of the cloak and dagger stuff. They think about James Bond. They think about, well, espionage. But the Espionage Act actually isn't about just espionage. It broadly punishes the sharing of information. So it applies to way more than just spies. And in fact, it's a law that's being currently used to prosecute all the whistleblowers you might have heard about. You may have followed the cases of Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, and of course, as we'll talk about on this program, the ongoing extradition of Julian Assange. So I really just want to emphasize those things, that one, it's not old news. Two, it's not just for the lawyers. And three, it's not just about spies.
Carrie, why does the prosecution of Julian Assange pose such a threat to the First Amendment? And where does that case stand at the present time?
So Julian Assange is facing extradition from the United Kingdom to face trial under the Espionage Act here in the U.S. He's not a U.S. government employee, not even a U.S. citizen. So what would that case mean? What would it mean if the U.S. has jurisdiction over anyone on Earth for exposing evidence of war crimes? And in fact, he did expose evidence of war crimes. Folks might remember even the collateral murder video back from 2010, which showed U.S. soldiers gunning down civilians in cold blood, journalists as well, like they were ants, like they were literal ants in the way that they were talking about it. This showed the world really for the first time, really truly for the first time, the realities on the ground and the lies that were being told about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and about U.S. foreign policy generally, about the shroud that was covering up the realities of the war crimes being committed. And this led to awards for journalism, for Assange, and for WikiLeaks. He won numerous awards, was recognized for it, and literally this reporting that's at the center of this case reshaped the journalism industry itself. It started conversations about what journalism actually is. There were conferences that I would go to. There were books written. There were constant academic articles and debates about the future of new media. And you look at outlets like ProPublica, you look at The Intercept. These are outlets that were directly inspired by the work of Julian Assange and of WikiLeaks, this model of data-based reporting. It's not something that's just some esoteric Julian Assange and WikiLeaks did some new type of reporting and then it faded out of view. It really reshaped the journalism industry permanently. This case isn't about the 2016 elections. That's a common myth that a lot of folks think. In the second superseding indictment against Assange, they don't even mention anything past 2015. It's not about the 2016 or any of that, but it doesn't talk about it at all. If you only take away one thing from our conversation today, it's this fact that Assange isn't a U.S. government employee. He's not even a U.S. citizen. He's not a government employee. He's not a U.S. citizen. Yet somehow, He's been in confinement in various forms for almost 15 years, first in an embassy, then in the high-security Belmarsh prison. And now he could face extradition to the U.S., where he would spend years, practically speaking, the rest of his life, what the government would pursue for everything I just described, for what led to this radical transformation of journalism, for these awards. And for anyone on earth, this would apply. Not even a U.S. citizen, not even a U.S. government employee. And the U.S. government is saying, no, we can bring you to the U.S. no matter who you are. You don't have to be a citizen. You could be anywhere on earth. You don't have to be in the U.S. You could just be exposing and reporting on things that we don't like. And you could face the rest of your life in prison as a result.
And what's the current status of his case?
So the current status of the case, it's making its way through the UK courts. There is just a application to appeal in the highest court of the UK that was granted following the failure of the US to offer assurances that Assange would have First Amendment protection, and we'll have a chance to unpack this a bit more. But right now, it's going to go to a final appeal in the UK. If he were to lose that appeal, he would face extradition to the US. There could be an appeal to the European Court of Human Rights, which is a superseding regional body that oversees Europe and the United Kingdom, even though the United Kingdom exited the European Union through Brexit. The European Court is technically, it's a different legal regime than the EU. It's the European Convention on Human Rights, which is a human rights treaty. So it's still binding on the UK. There are some questions about whether the UK would respect the jurisdiction of the European Court, but I think recent years have shown that they would likely take it seriously for a number of reasons, but those are just my personal thoughts. Right now, it's making its way in the UK. I believe they just announced that the arguments will be in early July, they'll begin. And then depending how that goes, then there could be further application to the European Court or extradition to the US if it's unsuccessful on the appeal.
In what ways did Donald Trump and his Justice Department wield the Espionage Act when he was in office? What can we expect if, God forbid, he returns to office? And how does that compare to the Obama administration and the Biden administration?
So Trump went on a full offensive against the press using the Espionage Act, and he did that by targeting media sources, by targeting whistleblowers. And I think folks probably are well aware of Trump's relationship with the press. He publicized it. He was very, very vocal about it. He literally called the press the enemy of the people. He constantly threatened and made personal attacks against journalists. But behind the scenes, too, his Justice Department was expanding use of the act, was expanding its policies of even issues like issuing subpoenas of reporters, of surveillance over reporters, and even contemplating prosecuting the press. The Trump administration changed course on many of the decisions that the Obama administration took. Those were decisions not to prosecute. So one very sad example is that of Daniel Hale. So Daniel Hale was a drone whistleblower. He blew the whistle on war crimes surrounding the U.S. drone program. He exposed evidence how the civilian deaths were way, way, way greater than anything that the U.S. was officially saying, and the so-called descriptions of precision targeting and all of this that we're still hearing actually today, that was all bogus, that actually it was quite indiscriminate and quite uncontrolled. So Daniel Hale, he was investigated under the Obama administration for allegedly providing that to Jeremy Scahill and as evidence for Scahill's book, and that the Obama administration declined to prosecute Hale. They said, okay, we're not going to pursue this case. But then after that, the Trump DOJ cleaned the dust off of that file and decided to reopen it up. Nothing had changed in the case. They just decided we're actually going to pursue this again. and they prosecuted Hale under the Espionage Act. They were successful, and Hale recently got out, actually, after serving several years behind bars. So these cases are very, very political, and I think they become even more politicized under Trump. It's very clear, I think, to anyone that Trump would have a huge vendetta if he returned to office. And with a precedent like the Assange case that would apply to anyone on earth, what would that mean under Trump? What would it mean under a Trump DOJ if he's angry, if he wants revenge, and he has a vaguely worded law, which the use of is expanding over the last years and can apply to anyone on earth? I mean, that's a very, very scary prospect. Does it mean that any story in the New York Times he doesn't like could get targeted under the act? And if you hear me saying, well, targeting the New York Times, you couldn't have that. That's just the lawyer, you know, this lawyer Kerry trying to make his case to prove a point. But that wouldn't actually happen. It actually would conceivably happen, very much so. And the New York Times is advocating against the Assange prosecution for that reason. Actually, the Obama DOJ talked about prosecuting the Times. Look back to 2013, when the Obama DOJ decided not to prosecute Assange. They actually, officials in the Obama administration, they told the Washington Post, there's a story back from that year, late 2013, people called it the New York Times problem, that you couldn't prosecute Assange without going after the New York Times. So that means if that case goes ahead, you literally are giving a weapon to Trump to go after the mainstream press and any national security reporter literally on earth. I think Biden would not fare much better. One of the things to keep in mind is that the Assange extradition began under Trump. Biden's had many opportunities to reverse course on that, to drop it, but he's declined each time. There have been some teasers that he's put out to the press. So recently he mentioned that the administration was considering rethinking its approach to the Assange case, but so far we haven't seen any action on that. So I don't think Biden's considerably better than Trump, but Trump is an absolute wild card. That's a wild card that's on a quest for revenge. So I think we're going to see bad stuff under both, but Trump is likely the complete disaster with this.
Kerry, a quick follow-up. What's the dark side of the Obama administration? Didn't he prosecute more whistleblowers than other presidents?
Yeah, so Obama, actually, you're absolutely correct. Obama essentially revived the Espionage Act to go after media sources and had ended up prosecuting more media sources under the Espionage Act than all U.S. presidents combined. And this really accompanied the rise of secrecy and the surveillance state in a way that was truly unprecedented. This was the stuff that Edward Snowden had exposed about NSA surveillance. And the exposures of these programs really shed light on the type of government intrusions. You had these tech changes, these technological changes that were also changing the legal landscape a bit, because before, to prosecute these cases, you had to have physical surveillance. One of the big parts, actually, about the Daniel Ellsberg case going back several decades, of course, the late Ellsberg, he passed away this past year. He was the source for the New York Times for the Pentagon Papers, the famous study of the Vietnam War that showed that the administration was lying to the American people about Vietnam. But Ellsberg, there are stories about how he used a photocopier. He took documents and he literally was on a copy machine with his kids. They were helping with parts of it too. And they were physically copying these pages, and the evidence around that of the U.S. finding him, of the FBI surveilling him, was physical surveillance. But now that's not how things work. Chelsea Manning allegedly burned files to CD, and you have whistleblowers who are accused of taking things on USB sticks, and digital technologies bring with them the ability of the government to surveil and to look at what folks are doing on systems and servers. So with that sophisticated surveillance, we've seen a huge uptick in the investigations and in the prosecutions. And that really, really took off under Obama.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Steve Rohde. We're speaking with attorney Kerry Shankman, the author of a really fine book called A Century of Repression, The Espionage Act and Freedom of the Press. Kerry, even if a journalist were to be targeted under the Espionage Act, the United States has a Bill of Rights and a strong tradition protecting freedom of speech and the press. So wouldn't the First Amendment protect journalists against prosecution under the Espionage Act?
So U.S. courts have said the First Amendment doesn't protect whistleblowers under the Espionage Act. That's legal precedent. The Court of Appeals, actually, that would govern where Assange would be sent in the Eastern District of Virginia. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has actually held that in the Morrison case in the 80s. Now, that case applied to whistleblowers, government insiders, rather than a publisher. But it's clear from the extradition proceedings so far what the U.S. position would be. The U.S. position is that Assange shouldn't be allowed to even raise the First Amendment. And that's consistent with the history of these cases. So in these cases, like the Daniel Hale case I mentioned, the prosecution was putting in motions before the court to ban defendants from using words like whistleblower, like talking about public interest in cases, meaning that it's not a matter of a judge listening to the arguments about war crimes and public interest and then deciding this wasn't in the public interest. It's no. You duct tape over your mouth. You're not allowed to say these words or bring this argument. You could be in, you know, violation of rules of procedure for even mentioning that. So these precedents haven't really been tested in the case of a publisher, but the U.S. is clear that folks shouldn't have First Amendment protection, no matter where on earth they are. So this is really the U.S. having its cake and eating it too. How I said that this was a prosecution of a non-U.S. citizen, non-U.S. government employee. But now the U.S. Department of Justice, it wants to apply that Espionage Act to anyone on earth. At the same time, it's saying that the First Amendment doesn't protect you. So anyone on earth could get nabbed, but then they wouldn't have First Amendment protection. So there's truly a double threat there. And yes, so I totally agree. There is a Bill of Rights. There is a First Amendment. That's what I devote my own work to try to defend cases on First Amendment grounds. But ultimately, in a case like this, the government's position is that it's a piece of paper that doesn't apply. Inherently scary.
Kerry, tell us about some of the defendants who face the Espionage Act. And how have they been treated over the course of American history?
Not well. Defendants in these cases, they get nailed to a cross in every stage of the case. During trial, as I mentioned, they can't mount an effective defense because the government says the First Amendment doesn't apply. Then at sentencing, the sentencing is severe. Years, decades. Chelsea Manning in her court-martial got 35 years until it was commuted by Obama. And the post-conviction life itself is horrible. So I mentioned Daniel Hale and the drone whistleblower again. And he was held in what's called a communication management unit. So you might ask, what the heck does that bureaucratic speak mean, communication management? Well, that's bureaucratic speak for total isolation. Communication management means isolated. In the same way that we use the term sometimes waste management, when we say we want to get rid of garbage, that's the government's way. Communication management is really getting rid of someone from their family, from their lawyers, from contact. It's truly dehumanizing. It's truly isolating. And the aim of it is not just individual cases. It's not abstract legal precedent. It's really to send a message. It's to send the message of this is what happens when you expose the crimes of the government. This is what's going to happen to you, and you better be careful because you're going to have to deal with this process. You're going to have to deal with this post-conviction life.
Kerry, what implications would prosecution of a journalist have, for instance, for U.S. journalists that are harassed or detained abroad on political charges, or for their investigative journalism? I'm thinking especially of the case of Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter, who was detained in Russia in March of 2023, and he still remains so today, on charges of espionage.
It would make things worse around the world, period. So everything that we just talked about, what would the headlines be in the U.S. around the world if Russia was doing the same thing, if China were doing it, if Saudi Arabia were doing it? These countries saying that they need to extradite someone from the U.S. for revealing war crimes done by those countries. And also saying, well, they wouldn't have a defense of free speech. They wouldn't even be able to talk about free speech, even if they weren't Russian, Chinese, or Saudi citizen. So when we talk about it this way, it's absolutely clear how totalitarian it is. And I think the media here would be overwhelmingly calling it out for what it is. The U.S. State Department, the president would be calling out this severe repression of dissent. But now we see the U.S. doing it. And I think apart from the impact on the rule of law, it has really scary impacts of what it means for when other countries want to do the same thing and then point to the U.S. saying, well, you did that, so why can't we?
To remind our listeners that you've written a very fine book called A Century of Repression, The Espionage Act and Freedom of the Press. Before we say goodbye, could you remind our listeners on how they might follow your work?
Sure. I would recommend the book, not just because I wrote it with Ralph Engelman, who's a brilliant media historian. But I think we really tried to provide a human impact of these cases. So I want to let folks know that even if you don't have a legal background, even if you're apprehensive about getting into the weeds, we really don't treat it. It's not a legal textbook. We really try to tell human stories. So I would recommend checking out the book. And I'm often commenting on these issues, too.
Carrie, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you for everything you do every day to defend freedom of expression.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Strength to stay to fight. Are those people who surround